This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for October 2008. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. Each month on the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature poems and talk about articles in the upcoming issue.
This month, we're going to hear poetry from Sarah Lindsay.
Who needs to hear a quagga's voice?
And from Laura Kosiski.
It will happen here. No doubt. Someday. Here.
And we're also going to call William Logan to talk about Hart Crane and an interesting experience that Logan had when he wrote a review.
I don't feel that Crane is the strongest of American poets, who in fact wrote very few good poems.
But as always, we like to begin by telling you about some other things in the issue.
We have a special section of letters this month between Robert Lowell and Elizabeth Bishop. And Don, you wrote the introduction for that, didn't you?
I did. And I plowed through this book being a fan of both Bishop's and Lowell's. And some of their letters have been published already in separate volumes before, but this has the complete correspondence between these two poets. And sometimes you think that poets like Elizabeth Bishop and Robert Lowell are like the faces on Mount Rushmore, and they're these monumental presences. But what you see in these letters, in our selection of them especially, is that there was a time when they didn't really know each other, and Bishop was actually afraid of meeting Robert Lowell because he was in his 20s and he was already making a name for himself, about to win a Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah, it's an amazing phenomenon, really, that you have two poets of this caliber writing letters of this caliber to each other. And I was particularly struck by one exchange in this. You can hear them talking about Richard Eberhardt, a poet that very few people read now, but at the time was well known. And Lowell says he's gotten a poem from Eberhardt, and he didn't like it, and Eberhardt has written back. And Lowell says, "More Eberhardt. I wrote him a peevish letter suggesting that a little revision wouldn't be ruinous. Then had pangs and wrote him that I liked his At Lake Geneva in Williams's anthology. Then came the enclosed, so pathetic. Verse is really too hard a profession, as Randall says." And of course, he's talking about Randall Jarrell. In her response, she says, "And Eberhardt, oh dear, I have an old teacher who wrote to me a little like that, but not nearly so bad. I wonder what the dreadful insecurity really comes from, because it seems to me he's received a good deal of attention." It's interesting to hear them talk about someone that's, you know, was a big figure, and it's actually very accurate.
Yeah.
And it's poignant, too, because in those same letters, a minute after talking about Eberhardt, Lowell says, "I'm feeling fine, except," then he has this little quote of a verse, "31, nothing done, keeps going through my head." And here's someone who's just won the Pulitzer Prize. This is Robert Lowell.
Not even 30 years old.
Right, right.
And then Bishop writes him back in a subsequent letter with her reply to that little versicle. And she says, 37 and far from heaven.
Yeah, it never goes away, that feeling of insecurity and inadequacy. I read a little thing about T.S. Eliot, who insisted on keeping his job in publishing precisely for that reason, because he just wasn't sure that his verse was good enough to base his whole life on.
Yeah.
We also have a lot of poems in this issue, a lot of wonderful poems. And one that I wanted to read was by Derek Sheffield. And it's a narrative poem. What we admired by it was the very efficient way that it went about telling its narrative. A lot of narrative poems, you read them and you wonder, why isn't this just written in prose? It could be better in prose, actually. So if a poem is going to tell a story, it needs to do it in some sort of way that couldn't be done in prose. This is straightforward, but it's told with great economy. A good fish. "Jerk that bitch," urges my guide, and I give my shuddering pole a jerk, hooking the throat of the first steelhead of my life. "Reel 'em," he mutters and revs the motor. I horse my pole and reel and horse. The boat's mascot whines, her claws clicking. "Let it take some line." My father, uncle, and cousin are reeling. "First fish," they shout, and I shout, "What a fighter!" A silver spine touches the air. "There," he points, "a hen. And guess what? She's going to join the club," somehow spotting in that glimpse the smooth place along her back where a fin had been snipped. He leans over the gunwale, dips a net, and scoops her into the boat. She is thick with a wide band of fiery scales, slapping the aluminum bottom. "Welcome to the club," he says, and clobbers her once, and again, and once more before she goes still. "A bleeder," he says, shaking his head and handing her to me. I curl a finger through a gill the way you're supposed to, determined not to let her slip and flop back to the river, a blunder I'd never live down. A good fist. Fish, I mean. A good fish.
Here's a poet, and he's worried about blunders, you know, making a mistake and worrying about the way you're supposed to do things. And for a while, you suspect it might be your typical gone fishing poem. We had one in the last issue.
Yeah, yeah.
But at the very end, it's almost like the poet, the voice of the poet there, makes a blunder, a good fish. That's really astonishing.
Yeah,
to
and
me.
It's an accident that's. I happen to know he wrote me about it. He said it was an actual accident. He was writing the poem. He miswrote the word. It's a lesson in how accident plays a part in art and how you have to sometimes let accident happen. But that accident, it's not an accident. You couldn't possibly have this build up to that and then say it's completely an accident because it is such a distillation of all the implicit violence.
Yeah, it reveals the real logic behind the poem.
Yeah.
That it's in your hands, that fishing is in your hands, that water slips between your fingers, that your fingers and your hands write and type up a poem and can slip up, slip and flop.
And it's also a very direct but statement about a certain kind of masculine energy mm-hmm. that they have this expectation of a guy who's presumably intellectual or a poet. And the expectation is that he'll participate in this. And you don't want to say violence. I mean, it's not violence. It's, you know, they're fishing. And yet there is some kind of collective energy there that the poem addresses because it's jerk that bitch it starts with. And it's it's male on female. It's very pointed that the fish is a she all the way through.
And the male is supposed to know what to do and be in control. And if he makes a mistake, it's a blunder that he will never live down. That's the sort of motivating energy behind all this restless activity.
Yeah, yeah. Also in the October issue, we have 8 poems from Sarah Lindsay. This is her first time in the magazine, and she has a new book coming out soon from Copper Canyon Press.
We're going to hear 2 of these poems now. First, a short one called Small Moth, which Lindsay says is an unusual poem for her.
I have difficulty writing poems about happiness that are convincing, and I also have trouble trying to get my dog into poems because the dog is very happy, very, very cute, and cute doesn't usually work in poetry very well unless you're being sarcastic about it.
Here's Sarah Lindsay reading Small Moth.
She's slicing ripe white peaches into the Tony the Tiger bowl and dropping slivers for the dog poised vibrating by her foot to stop their fall when she spots it, camouflaged, a glimmer, and then full on happiness. Flashing blunt, soft wings inside her as if it wants to escape again.
What strikes me is it's a moment of vision because the moth is clearly not real. It's inside of her, but it happens amid these very banal daily things. And that we think of happiness as cascading upon us and, you know, we're running through a field in a toothpaste commercial or something with big grins on our face. And here, she gets at some truth, which is the way that happiness actually occurs, which is amid ordinariness, you know, mm-hmm. amid the very ordinary things that we do in our day. And I think she's found a perfect metaphor for showing us that.
It's a very sly poem, and the language doesn't draw attention to itself, but it's very accomplished. So when it starts off, she's slicing ripe white peaches.
Yeah.
It's got that very staccato diction. But then when it gets into the kind of soft, mushy heart of itself, then it becomes more liquid, you know, plashing blunt, soft wings inside her.
Yeah. And the sadness in this poem is that this happiness is going to escape again. The moth calls attention to itself by beating its wings. It's beating its wings because it's on its way.
It's on its way, and it doesn't even know why. It just is.
Right.
Seems like we have a lot of animal poems in front of us today.
It was unintentional, but
it's just one of those things.
Yeah.
And it turns out that Sarah Lindsay's poem, Elegy for the Quagga, is also an animal poem.
For those of you who never got the news, including me, the quagga is a type of zebra that went extinct in 1883, and they lived on the plains in southern Africa. And 15 days after the last one died, the Indonesian island of Krakatau, I think that's the correct pronunciation. We sometimes know it as Krakatoa. It's an English pronunciation. At any rate, that island almost completely disappeared in one of the largest explosions in history, and it made so much noise that you could hear it thousands of miles away.
The entire island was just blown into the air, practically. There was just a little scrap of it left that was hot. And then months and months later, they were monitoring it out of scientific curiosity, and I guess the first thing they found there that was alive was a spider that had apparently blown onto it from somewhere else.
Krakatoa and the extinction of the quagga were unrelated, but Sarah Lindsay considers them both in her poem, Elegy for the Quagga.
Krakatoa split with a blinding noise and raised from gutted, steaming rock a pulverized black sky over water walls that swiftly fell on Java and Sumatra. 15 days before, in its cage in Amsterdam, the last known member of Equus quagga, the southernmost subspecies of zebra, died. Most of the wild ones, not wild enough, grazing near the Cape of Good Hope, had been shot and skinned and roasted by white hunters. When a spider walked on cooling Krakatoa's skin, no quagga walked anywhere, while seeds pitched by long winds onto newborn fields burst open and rooted. Perhaps some thistle flourished on the quagga's discarded innards. The fractured island greened and hummed again. Handsome zebras tossed their heads in zoos on hired safari planes. Who needs to hear a quagga's voice, or see the warm hide twitch away a fly, see the neck turn, curving its cream and chestnut stripes that run down to plain dark haunches and plain white legs? A kind of horse, less picturesque than a dodo. Still, we mourn what we mourn, even if, when it sank to its irreplaceable knees, when its unique throat closed behind a sigh, no dust rose to redden a whole year's sunsets. No one unwittingly busy 2,000 miles away jumped at the sound. No ashes rained on ships in the merciless sea.
It's a striking question that we get in the second stanza, who needs to hear a quagga's voice? Suddenly you want to hear it. Never thought of a quagga, but you want to know what it sounds like.
That last stanza reminds me a bit of Auden's Musée des Beaux-Arts, where, you know, Icarus falls into the ocean and other people are going about their daily business and don't really turn to see it or hear it.
Yeah. The odd thing, though, is that, you know, the way she links these events that weren't obviously linked, unless you believe in some sort of deep metaphysical causation, the quagga goes extinct and there's this volcano.
If a butterfly flapped its wings.
Right, exactly. But in a sense, you know, when she says no dust rose
to redden a whole year's sunsets, no one unwittingly busy 2,000 miles away jumped at the sound. No ashes rained on ships in the merciless sea.
But in fact, they did. Mm-hmm. I mean, 2 weeks later, they did jump at the sound. They jumped, you know, there was some sort of effect. And so she has transformed these events to have some relevance to each other. And it's not a false relevance either. Because she doesn't press it, you know.
Yeah. What she does here is impart a kind of movement to all these things. So when the spider's walking around and there's no quagga walking around because it's just gone, these seeds have been, she says, pitched by long winds.
Long winds onto newborn fields burst open and rooted.
And then she says,
perhaps some thistle flourished on the quagga's discarded innards.
You don't often think of a thistle flourishing on something's innards. So you can see the movement and growth that happens here in this landscape. And then she says, the fractured island greened and hummed again.
Yeah. Laura Kosciski has appeared in the magazine on various occasions, going back to the early 90s. She has a couple of poems in our October issue, and we're going to hear one called After Ken Burns.
I think it's an unusual poem for Laura. I first came across her work about 15 years ago after her first book came out. And her poems are very intense, not bookish. But over the years, especially with these poems here, what I see is a kind of change in her work that's quite interesting, where the intensity here is kind of broken up a little bit. The lines are kind of intense but distracted. It's hard to connect them up. There's a lot going on. I suspect that has something to do with the fact that the TV must be on, and you turn on PBS and there's inevitably Ken Burns.
Well, we asked her to explain what she meant by the title After Ken Burns. Here's what she said.
I wrote it, or I was inspired to write it, not too long after having watched the documentary about the Civil War. And I think it was his accumulation of voices from the past that sort of catapulted me into the future and thinking about the inevitability of history, of war, and the moat that I think I imagine around my, you know, the safe moat around my life and my place is pretty imaginary.
Here's Laura Kosciski reading After Ken Burns.
The beautiful plate I cracked in half as I wrapped it in tissue paper, as if the worship of a thing might be the thing that breaks it. This river, which is life, which is wayfaring, this river, which is also sky, this dipper, full of mind, which is not only the hysterical giggling of girls, but the trembling of the elderly, not only the scales, beaks, and teeth of creatures, but also their imaginative names, elephant, peacock, and their love of one another, the excited preparations they sometimes make for their own deaths. It is as if some graceful goddess, wandering in the dark, desperate with thirst, bent down and dropped that dipper, clumsily in this river. It floated away. Consciousness, memory, sensory information, the historians and their glorious war. The pineal gland, tiny pine cone in the forehead, our third eye. Of course. It will happen here. No doubt. Someday, here, in this little house, they will lay the wounded side by side. The blood will run into the basement through the boards. Their ghosts are already here, along with a cracked plate wrapped in old paper in the attic. And the woman who will turn one day at the window to see a long, strange line of vehicles traveling slowly toward her door, which she opens. What choice does she have, although she has not yet been born?
This poem hinges on that "it" in the middle. It will happen here.
Yeah.
Which I take to be some kind of violence. Or
the war that's always with us, without, you know, outside her door, on TV, but also something that seeps through the basement, through the boards, and the ghosts that are here.
And that's projected into the future. Presumably this plate must be a family memento.
The beautiful plate I cracked in half as I wrapped it in tissue paper, as if the worship of a thing might be the thing that breaks it.
The second line is very provocative, as if the worship of a thing might be the thing that breaks it. Very relevant for you to think of a sort of religion can become so brittle at sometimes when the kind of fervor that makes it become brittle, and the worship of it, the over-adulation of it, actually does break it.
Yeah, the kind of feverishness that results in something completely unintended.
Right.
You know, the other thing I think of with all this kind of educational TV stuff is like Antiques Roadshow.
Oh, yeah.
So you get Ken Burns 1 minute, and you've got those valuable China dishes.
Right. Sell it.
The next breath, yeah.
It is as if some graceful goddess, wandering in the dark, desperate with thirst, bent down and dropped that dipper, clumsily in this river. It floated away.
That graceful goddess in the past, wandering in the dark, desperate with thirst, that's very intriguing to me. I remember some of her, Laura Kosciski's earlier poems were influenced by things like Medea. She did versions of that.
Hmm.
And now the goddess has become graceful, wandering in the dark, desperate with thirst, sort of bent down and dropped that dipper clumsily in this river.
Mm-hmm.
What is this river?
This river, which is life, which is wayfaring, this river, which is also sky, this dipper, full of mind, which is not only the hysterical giggling of girls, but the trembling of the elderly. The dipper was inspired by Ken Burns and his strategy for making these documentaries, sort of dipping into the river of history and of time and bringing back the details and the people from it. And in my imagining, the graceful goddess who would be, in an ideal world, protecting us, looking out for us, making history a beautiful thing, instead has this clumsy act where she drops the dipper.
And it floated away. The means of sustenance floats away down the river.
And then and then also what she says about the animals, the excited preparations they sometimes make for their own deaths, that word excited.
Mm-hmm. Like it's a good thing.
Exactly, yeah. It's a surprising moment there. So there are three times here. I think there's the past, and there's the present, where this poet is meditating, and then there's the future, where she imagines essentially a return of this kind of violence.
Their ghosts are already here, along with a cracked plate wrapped in old paper in the attic. And the woman who will turn one day at the window to see a long, strange line of vehicles traveling slowly toward her door, which she opens. What choice does she have, although she has not yet been born?
In 2006, the Library of America published Hart Crane's Complete Poems and Selected Letters, and William Logan, a poet, critic, and a frequent contributor to Poetry Magazine, reviewed the book, not for us, but for the Times Book Review. Logan came down pretty hard on Crane's poetry, some people thought, and the Times got a lot of letters about it.
For the October issue of Poetry, William Logan has written an essay about the experience of reviewing the beloved Hart Crane and the vociferous response from his readers. He joins us by phone from Gainesville, Florida.
Hi, William.
Chris, Don, pleased.
Glad to have you here. Remind us what you said in your Times review that got everybody so angry.
Well, I guess the critic never exactly knows what it is that ticks people off about his opinions. I suspect it was in part that I don't feel that Crane is the strongest of American poets. I think he has wonders in the verse here and there, but that I feel that he's a partial, a fragmented poet who in fact wrote very few good poems. He wrote a lot of wonderful lines.
I'm in pain even as I'm listening to this. listen, in your essay you say that reviewing Crane, if you don't review him fondly, it's like poking a pencil into a hornet's nest. So tell us, who are some of the hornets who came after you?
Oh, I suppose some of the usual suspects. There was one of the biographers of Crane, Paul Mariani, Dan Halpern, Rosanna Warren. The Times chose letters, for the most part, by poets and critics, but I imagine there were others as well. There are a lot of lovers of Crane, and I have nothing against people who love poetry I don't love. That doesn't seem to me a problem at all. I'm all for argument, and so I can hardly complain that people were vociferous in their opinions.
those are not
my opinions.
Did you have the kind of experience that you talk about in the essay where a young person may be particularly drawn to Crane, but then as they get older, they're not? Would that happen to you?
No, not at all. I've never been wholly in love with Hart Crane, though, as I say, I like lots of parts. I was asked by a beloved teacher of mine long, long ago who had influenced me, and I said, Crane. He said, Hart? I said, no, Stephen. And there was a coolness for a while thereafter.
You know, when you love somebody or love a poet, you love them even with their imperfections. I mean, I know you can understand why people get so riled up about what you said. Tell us your response to people like us who just put up with Hart Crane, even though he wrote all those things you point out.
I guess for me is that I'm not willing to accept that the weaknesses and the strengths are divisible, or that you can love a poet for his weaknesses, or even in despite of the weaknesses. For me, the weaknesses always stand out rather harshly. When, as in a poet like Crane, there is, again, in my opinion, there's not a lot to love once the weaknesses are removed. Though I think that if I were in the mood for some bardic rapture, I would turn to Crane before a lot of other poets. The curious thing for me is that when Crane lovers say, well, you're not taking full account of this poem or that poem or the other poem, but it's always the same two or three poems. It's never the weak poems. So I suppose what I'm trying to say is that I think that critics of Crane and lovers of Crane actually see pretty much the same thing. Maybe they just come down upon it a little differently.
Do you think you convinced anybody?
I'm not sure that life as a critic would be bearable if you thought you had to convince me.
Right. Well, you say, I ask because, you know, that we take as our cover quote on the back of the magazine this month something that you said, a critic makes himself necessary to the extent that when reading him we whisper, no, no, no. Now, I wonder what you meant by that.
Well, I think that critics are good as provocateurs. That is, it's always better for me to read a critic with whom I disagree than to read a critic with whom I absolutely agree. I won't learn as much usually from the latter. But the former, it will make me think about my opinions, and even if they're diametrically opposed, it will make them clearer and sharper. So I like reading critics I disagree with.
Now, this isn't in your essay, but a while back you also went after another. Sacred cow doesn't seem like the right term, but let's say you discussed Frank O'Hara's reputation. Now, these are two sacred poets who died prematurely. Do you think that, I mean, is there something they might have done? Would they have gone on to write poems that would have changed your feelings about them?
It's possible, though I fear looking at the careers of all the major poets that so few of them wrote well after a sort of 10-year period. that we might have seen the best of both Crane and O'Hara. What happened later for them, as might have happened for Plath, might have been a lot lesser. It could have been greater. I mean, no one can say. I think part of the cult is the belief that the poet was on some sort of upward trajectory, and death cut that short. There's a kind of cult of loss there, which I believe will happen to David Foster Wallace, our most recent death of that sort. And all of these deaths are sad, but I object mildly to the letter writer who said that Crane's death was tragic. I don't think that kind of death is tragic in any real sense. It's terribly, terribly sad.
Do you blame Crane for the lack of a good American epic poem? I know you talk about, you know, there's been an epic novel. It's Moby Dick, a great American novel, but you say there's no great American poem. Is that Crane's fault at all?
No. Of course, it's not his fault. I don't think that Crane had it in him to write that epic, though that was his ambition, and there's nothing wrong with that ambition. Though I think that the failure of The Bridge is something that did cast a shadow over people who wanted to write epics for a long while thereafter. One of the letter writers suggested that we had had all sorts of long poems since then, and I think that's right, but they are mostly fragmented. They're collections of lyrics, as you know, let us face it, Leaves of Grass was. But an integrated American epic, I think that would be a most difficult thing to write. There's something about the subject that seems to drive American poets absolutely dotty when they begin to write about it. That is, to write about their own country. When you read MacLeish or Frost, whenever it turns to America or Marianne Moore, the sentimentality, the bogus patriotism, it all comes to the fore.
In the essay, you say that criticism is the exercise of taste under the guise of objectivity. So what's the point of criticism? Is it to develop other people's tastes?
Well, maybe there isn't a point.
<Uh-oh>.
But I don't believe that criticism is scientific. I think that it is a matter of taste. It can be taste objectified. It can be taste rationalized. It can be even be taste put on principles, though I think that my principles would be kind of muzzy. But I think that finally it's an argument about taste. From the point of view of taste, and therefore as interesting or as uninteresting as other such arguments are.
All right, thanks so much, William.
Thank you.
Good talking to you, gents.
You can read William Logan's essay and everything else you've heard on this program in the October issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
If you have any comments or questions you'd like to ask us, email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. Maybe we'll call you back and talk to you on this program.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is produced by Curtis Fox and Ed Herman, with recording help from Michelle Johnson and Peggy Watson.
The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scher.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.